It had also been marked with capital A's and a B. Whoever was doing this certainly wanted to take credit for the murders. The murders weren't improvisatory, but the killer's methods were dynamic. And evolving, of course. "What are you thinking?" Paige asked. "Do you mind if I ask? Or am I getting in the way?" Before I could tell him, another agent interrupted the two of us. If it was possible, she was tanner and maybe even blonder than Agent Paige. I wondered if maybe they'd been put together at the same factory. "We've got another email at the LA Times," she said. "Same editor, Arnold Greiner, and the same Mary Smith." "Has the paper reported on the emails yet?" I asked. Both agents shook their head. "Good. Let's try to keep it that way. And keep a cap on these kids' stickers, too, if we can. And the A's and B's." I checked my watch. Already 5:30. I needed at least another hour at the Schiffman property. Then I wanted to speak with Arnold Greiner at the Times. And I would definitely have to meet with the LAPD before the day was over. James Truscott was probably still prowling around outside, too. At home in D.C., I missed meals as often as not. Nana and the kids were used to it, and Jamila would probably understand, but none of that was an excuse. This had been as good a time as any to break one of my very worst habits in life, missing dinner with my family. But it wasn't going to happen, was it? I called Nana at the hotel first, and then I called Jamila. Then I thought about the poor Schiffman and Bennett families, and I went back to work. Part 2. I Love L.A. Chapter 15. Why me, of all people? Why do you think she's writing these awful missives to me? It doesn't make any sense, does it? Have you found out anything that makes some sense of this? The mothers being slaughtered? Hollywood's about to go totally insane over these murders, trust me. Mary's dirty little secret will get out. Arnold Greiner had already asked me the same questions a couple of times during the interview. Our meeting was taking place in an L-shaped glass fishbowl of an office at the heart of the LA Times newsroom. The rest of the floor was a wide expanse of desks and cubicles. From time to time, someone would pop his or her head over a cubicle wall, steal a quick glance our way, and duck back down. "Prairie dogging," Greiner called it, chuckling to himself. He sat on a brown leather couch, clutching and unclutching the knees of his wrinkled gray dockers. Occasionally, he scribbled something on a legal pad on his lap. The conversation so far had focused on Greiner's background. Yale, followed by an internship at Variety, where he proofed copy and ran coffee for entertainment reporters. He had earned a staff position quickly and famously when he managed to interview Tom Cruise on the record at an industry party. 2 years ago, the LA Times had wooed him away with an offer for his own column, Behind the Screens. His reputation in the business, he told me, was for insider Hollywood stories and edgy reviews. He obviously had a very high opinion of himself. I hadn't found any further links between Greiner and either of the murders outside of the movie industry connection. Still, I wasn't prepared to believe that he'd been randomly selected to receive Mary Smith's emails. Greiner didn't seem inclined to believe it either. His focus was all over the place, though, and he'd been peppering me with questions since we started. I finally sat down close to him. "Mr. Greiner, will you relax? Please." "Pretty easy for you to say," he shot back, and then almost immediately said, "Sorry, sorry." He put two fingers to his forehead and rubbed between his eyes. "I'm high-strung to begin with, ever since I was a kid growing up in Greenwich." I'd seen this kind of reaction, a mix of paranoia and anger that comes from getting blindsided the way Arnold Greiner had been. When I spoke again, I kept my voice just low enough that he'd have to concentrate to hear me. "I know you've already gone over this, but can you think of any reason you might be receiving these messages?" Let's start with any prior contact you've had with Patsy Bennett, Antonia Schiffman, or even the limo driver, Bruno Cappelletti. He shrugged, rolled his eyes, tried desperately to catch his breath. We might have been at some of the same parties, at least the two women. I've certainly reviewed their movies. The last was one of Antonia's, Canterbury Road, which I hated, I'm sorry to say, but I loved her in it and said so in the piece. Do you think that could be the connection? Maybe the killer reads my stuff. I mean, she must, right? This is so incredibly bizarre. How could I possibly fit into an insane murder scheme? Before I could say anything at all, he threw out another of his rapid-fire questions. Do you think Antonia's driver was incidental? In the email, it seems like he was just in the way. Greiner was obviously hungry for information, both personally and professionally. He was a reporter, after all, and already reasonably powerful in Hollywood circles. So I gave him my stock reporter's response. It's too early to say. What about Patsy Bennett? I asked. Do you remember the last time you wrote about one of her films? Something she produced? She still produced films occasionally, right? Greiner nodded. Then he sighed loudly, almost theatrically. Do you think I should discontinue my column for now? I should, shouldn't I? Maybe I better. The interview was like a ping-pong match against a kid with ADD. I eventually managed to get through all my questions, but it took almost twice as long as I thought it would when I had arrived at the Times. Greiner constantly needed reassurance, and I tried to give it to him without being completely dishonest. He was in danger, after all. One last thing, Greiner said just before I left him. Do you think I should write a book about this? Is that a little sick? I didn't bother to answer either question. He went to Yale. He should be able to figure it out. Chapter 16. After the interview, I slouched out to Arnold Greiner's desk to touch base with Paul LeBlue, the LAPD tech in charge of tracing Mary Smith's emails. He tapped away on the keyboard of Greiner's computer while he spoke to me in a rapid-fire patter. Two emails came through two different proxy servers. First one originated from a cyber cafe in Santa Monica. That means Mary Smith could be one of a few hundred people. She's got two different addresses, so far. Both just generic Hotmail accounts, which tells us nothing, really. Except we do know that she signed up for the first one from the library at USC, day before the first message. I had to concentrate just to follow LeBlue. Did everybody out here have ADD? What about the second email? I asked him. Transmission didn't originate in the same place as the first one. That much I can tell you. Did it come from the LA area? Can you tell me that? Don't know yet. When will you know? Probably end of the day. Not that it's going to be much help. He leaned forward and squinted at several lines of code on the screen. Mary Smith knows what she's doing. There it was again. She. I understood why everyone was using the pronoun. I was doing it too, but only for the sake of convenience. That didn't mean I was convinced the killer was a woman, though. Not yet, anyway. The letters to Greiner could represent some kind of persona. But whose? Chapter 17. How do you like your vacation so far, Alex? Having a lot of fun? I took copies of both bizarre emails and headed out for a meeting with the LAPD. The Detective Bureau of North Los Angeles Street was only a quarter mile from the Times offices, a Los Angeles miracle, given the cliche that it takes 45 minutes to get anywhere in the city. Oh, the vacation's great. I'm seeing all the sights. The kids are loving it, too. Nana is over the moon. I walked slowly, rereading the two emails on my way to LAPD. Even if the writing was persona-based, it had come from the mind of the killer. I started with the first one, which described the last moments of Patsy Bennett's life. It was definitely chilling, this diary of a psychopath.
2. A. Greiner at LATimes.com. From Mary Smith. To Patrice Bennett. I am the one who killed you. Isn't that some sentence? I think so. Here's another one that I like quite a lot. Somebody, a total stranger, will find your body in the balcony at the Westwood Village Theater. You, Patrice Bennett. Because that's where you died today, watching your last movie. And not a very good one at that. The Village? What were you thinking? What could have brought you to the theater on this day, the day of your death, to see The Village? You should have been home, Patsy, with your darling little children. That's where a good mom belongs. Don't you think so? Even if you spend much of your home time reading scripts and on the phone playing studio politics. It took me a long time to get so close to you. You are a big somebody at your studio. And I am just one of the nobodies who watches movies on video and Entertainment Tonight and Access Hollywood. I couldn't even get inside the big arched entrance at your studio. No siree. All I could do was watch your dark blue Aston Martin going in and out, day after day. But I'm a really patient person. I've learned how to wait for what I want. Speaking of waiting, that incredible house of yours is hard to see from the street. I did spot your lovely children, a couple of times actually. And I know with some time I could have found a way into the house. But then today, you changed everything. You went to a movie in the middle of the afternoon, just like you say you do in some of your interviews. Maybe you missed the smell of popcorn. Do you ever take your little girls to the movies, Patsy? You should have, you know. As they say, it all goes by in a blink. It didn't make sense to me at first. You're such a busy little big shot. But then I figured it out. Movies are what you do. You must see them all the time. But you also have a family waiting for you every night. You're supposed to be home for dinner with little Lynn and Lori. How old are they now? 12 and 13? They want you there. And you want to be there. That's good, I suppose. Except that tonight, dinner is going to come and go without you. Kind of sad when you think about it, which is what I'm doing right now. Anyway, you sat in the balcony in the 9th row. I sat in the 12th. I waited and watched the back of your head, your brunette from a bottle hair. That's where the bullet was going. Or so I fantasized. Isn't that what one is supposed to do at the movies? Escape? Get away from it all? Except that most movies are so dismal these days. Dismally dumb or dismally dreary. I didn't actually pull out my gun until after the film started. I didn't like how scared I felt. That was how scared you were supposed to be, big shot. But you didn't know what was happening. Not even that I was there. You were out of the loop. I sat like that, holding the gun in my lap, pointing it at you for the longest time. Then I decided I wanted to be closer, right on top of you. I needed to look in your eyes after you knew you'd been shot, knew that you would never see Lynn and Lori again, never see another movie either, never green light one, never again be a big shot. But then seeing you wide-eyed and dead was a surprise, a shock to my nervous system, actually. What happened to that famed aristocratic bearing of yours? That's why I had to leave the theater so quickly. And why I had to leave you undone. Not that you really care anymore. How's the weather where you are now, Patsy? Hot, I hope. Hot as Hades. Isn't that an expression? Do you miss your children terribly? Have some regrets? I'll bet you do. I would if I were you. But I'm no big shot. Just one of the little people.
Chapter 18. 9 o'clock, and all was not well, to put it mildly. LAPD Detective Jean Galetta's handshake was surprisingly soft. She looked as though she could give out bone crushers if she wanted to. Her orange short-sleeved turtleneck showed off her biceps. She was slim, though, with a strikingly angular face and the kind of piercing brown eyes that could make you stare. I caught myself mid-stare and glanced away. "Agent Cross, have I kept you waiting?" she asked. "Not very long," I told her. I'd been in Galetta's position before. When you're a lead investigator on a high-profile case, everyone wants a piece of your time. Besides, my day was almost over. Detective Galetta would probably be up all night. This case warranted it. The mess had landed in her lap about 12 hours ago. It had originated at the West Bureau in Hollywood, but serial cases were automatically transferred downtown to the Special Homicide Unit. Technically, Mary Smith couldn't be classified as a serial killer until there were at least 4 attributed murders, but LAPD had decided to err on the side of caution. I agreed with the decision, not that anyone had asked me for an opinion. The media coverage on this one and the subsequent pressure on the department was already intense. It could go from intense to insane soon if the emails to the Times got out. Detective Galetta led me upstairs to a small conference room turned crisis room. It acted as a makeshift clearinghouse for all information related to the murders. One entire wall was already covered with police reports, a map of the city, sketches of the 2 crime scenes, and dozens of photographs of the dead. A wastebasket in the corner overflowed with empty cups and greasy restaurant takeout bags. Wendy's seemed to be winning the battle of the burgers at this precinct. 2 detectives in shirt sleeves sat at a large wooden table, both of them bent over separate piles of paperwork. Familiar. Depressing. "We need this space," Galetta said to the detectives. There was nothing overly aggressive about it. She had the kind of unassuming confidence that made bullying unnecessary. The 2 men cleared out without a word. "Where do you want to start?" I asked her. Galetta jumped right in. "What do you make of the sticker thing?" She pointed to an 8.5 by 11 black and white photo of the back of a movie seat. It had the same brand of kiddie stickers on it as the ones left on Antonia Schiffman's limo. Each sticker was marked either A or B. One of the stickers showed a wide-eyed pony, the other 2 a teddy bear on a swing. What was with the killer and children? And mothers? "It feels awfully heavy-handed to me," I told her. "Just like everything else so far. The overwrought emails, the shootings at close range, the knife work. Hell, the celebrities. Whoever's doing this wants to go big, very high profile."
"Yeah, definitely. But what about the kiddie stickers themselves? I mean, why stickers? Why that kind? What's with the A's and B's? Must mean something."
"She's mentioned the victim's kids both times, in the emails. Kids are a part of this puzzle, a piece. To be honest, I've never come across anything even remotely like it." Galetta bit her lip and looked at the floor. I waited to see what she would say next.
"We've got 2 threads here. It's all film industry, Hollywood, at least so far. But there's the mother thing, the kids. Never mentions the husbands in either email."
She spoke slowly, mulling it over, the way I often did.
"She's either a mother herself, or has a thing for mothers. Mommies."
"You're assuming Mary Smith is a woman?" I asked. Chapter 19. Detective Galetta rocked back on the heels of her Nikes, and then she looked at me quizzically.
"You don't know about the hair?" Who's been briefing you anyway?
I felt a pang of frustration about my own time being wasted again. I sighed, then asked Galetta, "What hair?" She went on to tell me LAPD had found a human hair under one of the stickers at the movie theater in Westwood. Testing indicated it was Caucasian female, and it was not Patrice Bennett's. The fact that it was trapped on a smooth vertical surface under the sticker gave it some pretty good weight as evidence, though certainly not ironclad. I juggled this new information with what I already knew as I gave Galetta my own take on Mary Smith. It included my gut feeling that we shouldn't rule out either sex just yet. But you should take everything I tell you with a grain of salt. I'm not an all-science kind of guy. She smirked, though the effect was pleasant enough. I'll take that into account, Agent Cross. Now what else? Do you have a media plan? I wanted to emphasize it as her plan, completely her show, which it was, of course. This was going to be my first and last day on the Mary Smith case. If I played it right, I wouldn't even have to say that out loud. I would just walk away. Here's my media plan. Jean Galetta reached up and flipped on a wall-mounted television. She punched through several channels, stopping wherever there was coverage of the two murders. The shocking double murder of actress Antonia Shiffman and her driver. We're taking you live now to Beverly Hills. Patrice Bennett's former assistant on the line. Many of them were national broadcasts, everything from CNN to E! Entertainment Television. Galetta pushed a button that muted the sound. This is the kind of crap that some reporters live for. I've got a 24-hour detail on both crime scenes just to keep these assholes away, plus the damn paparazzi. It's totally out of control, and it's going to get much worse. You've been through it. You have any suggestions? Did I ever? We had all learned a few painful lessons about the double-edged sword of media coverage with the DC sniper case a few years back. Here's my take on it, for what it's worth, and I hope it's something. Don't try to control the coverage because you never will, I told her. The only thing you can control is what crime scene information gets out there. Put a gag order on everyone connected to the case. No interviews without specific permission from the department. And, this might sound a little crazy, but get a couple of people onto a phone detail. Call every retired officer you can find. Tell them not to make any comments to the press, nothing at all. Retired cops can be one of your biggest problems. Some of them just love making up theories for the camera. She gave me another sly smile. Not that you have an opinion about all this or anything. I shrugged. Believe me, most of it was learned the hard way. While I spoke, Detective Galetta paced slowly in front of the big wall board, absorbing the evidence. That's the way to do it. Let the details gather in the corners of your mind, where they'll be when you need them. I could already tell that she had good instincts. Healthy cynicism, for sure, but she was also a listener. It was easy to see how she'd come into her position so young. Now, could she survive this? I said, "Just one more thought. Mary Smith is probably going to be watching what you do. My suggestion is, don't disparage her or her work publicly, at least not yet. She's already playing it as a media game, right?"
"Yeah, that's true. I think so."
Detective Galetta stopped and looked up at the silent TV images.
"She's probably eating this all up with a spoon."
My thought, too. And this monster needed to be fed very, very carefully. This lady monster? Chapter 20. It was just after midnight when I finally got back to the hotel at Disney and received some more bad news. It wasn't just that Jamila had flown back to San Francisco. I already knew that much and figured I was in the doghouse again with Jam. When I entered the hotel room, I saw that Nana Mama was fast asleep on the sofa. A cluster of pale blue crocheting was still wrapped around her fingers.
She slept peacefully, like a child. I didn't want to disturb the poor girl, but she came awake on her own. It had always been that way with Nana. When I was little, all I had to do was stand next to her bed if I was sick or had a nightmare. She always said that she watched over me, even while she was sleeping. Had she been watching over me tonight? I stared at the old woman for a quiet moment. I don't know how most people feel about their grandparents, but I loved her so much it hurt sometimes. Nana raised me from the age of 10. I finally leaned down and kissed her on the cheek. "Did you get my voicemail?" I asked. Nana glanced absently at the hotel phone with its flashing red message light. "I guess not," I said with a shrug. She put a hand on my forearm. "Oh, Alex. Christine was here at the hotel. She came and she took little Alex back to Seattle. He's gone." My brain had a quick, does-not-compute moment. Christine wasn't due to pick Alex up for another 2 days. She currently had custody of our son, but the trip to Disneyland had been talked out and agreed to. She even said it was a good idea. I sat down hard on the edge of the couch. "I don't understand. What do you mean she took Alex home? What's going on? Tell me everything." Nana shoved her crocheting into a tapestry bag at her side. "I was so mad I could have spit. She didn't seem like herself at all. She was shouting, Alex. She shouted at me, even at Janelle. What was she doing here anyway? She wasn't supposed to. She came down early. That's the worst part. Alex, I think she was coming to spend some quality time with you and little Alex. With all of us. And then when she found out you were working, she completely changed. Turned into an angry hornet, just like that. There was nothing I could say to her. I never saw anyone so angry, so changed." It was all coming too fast, and I struggled with a barrage of feelings. Most of all, I realized I hadn't even gotten to say goodbye to my son, and now he was gone again. "What about Alex? How was he?" "He was confused and seemed sad, the poor little boy. He asked for you when his mother took him away. He said you promised him this would be a vacation. He'd so looked forward to it. We all did. You know that, Alex." My heart clenched, and I saw Alex's face in my mind. It felt as though he was getting farther and farther from me, as if a piece of my life was slipping away. "How were Janny and Damon about it?" I asked then. Nana sighed heavily. "They were brave soldiers, but Janny cried herself to sleep tonight. I think Damon did too. He hides it better. Poor things, they just moped around most of the night." We sat together on the sofa for a long, silent moment. I didn't know what to say. "I'm sorry I wasn't here today," I finally told Nana. "I know that doesn't mean much." She took my chin in her hand and stared into my eyes. "Here it comes, batten down the hatches." "You're a good man, Alex, and you're a good father. Don't you forget that, especially now. You have a very difficult job." A few minutes later, I slipped into the room where Janny and Damon were sleeping. The way they lay on the covers, they looked like little kids again. I liked the visual effect, and I stood there just watching them. Nothing ever healed me the way these two did. My babies, no matter how old you are. Janny slept at the edge of her bed with the comforter and a wad off to the side. I went over and covered her up. "Dad?" Damon's whisper from behind caught me off guard. "That you?" "What's up, Day?" I sat down on the edge of his bed and rubbed his back. I'd been doing it since he was an infant and wouldn't stop until he made me. "You have to work tomorrow?" he asked.
Is it tomorrow already?
There was no malice in his voice. He was too good a person for that. If I was a pretty good father, Damon was a great son. No, I told him. Not tomorrow. We're on vacation, remember? Chapter 21. For the second day in a row, I got a disturbing wake-up call, though. This one was from Fred Van Allsburg, the assistant director in charge of the FBI's Los Angeles office. I had seen the name on organizational charts, but we'd never actually met or even spoken. Still, he treated me with a kind of instant familiarity over the phone.
"Alex, how are you enjoying the vacation?" he asked within seconds of saying hello.
Did everyone know my business?
"Fine, thanks," I answered. "What can I do for you?" "Listen, thanks very much for making yourself available on Mary Smith yesterday. We've got a good jump on this case and what feels like a relatively functional relationship with LAPD. Listen, I'll cut right to the chase. We'd like you to represent us for the rest of the investigation out here. It's big, and it's important to us, and obviously to the director. This case is going to be huge, unfortunately."
I thought of a line from The Godfather Part 3. "Just when I thought I was out, they pull me back in." Not this time, though. I hadn't slept much, but I did wake with a clear sense of what this day was going to be about, and it had absolutely nothing to do with Mary Smith or any other heinous murder investigation. "I'm going to have to give my regrets on this one. I've got family commitments that I cannot turn my back on."
"Yes, I understand," he said, too quickly to have meant it. "But maybe we could pry you away for just a while, a few hours in the day."
"I'm sorry. You can't. Not right now." Van Allsburg sighed heavily on the other end of the line. When he spoke again, his tone was more measured. I don't know if I was reading him right, but I got a hint of condescension, too.
"Do you know what we're dealing with here? Alex, have you seen the news this morning?"
"I'm trying to stay away from the news for a few days. Remember, I'm on vacation. I need a vacation. I just came off the wolf."
"Alex, listen, we both know this isn't over. People are dying here. Important people."
"Important people?
What the hell was that supposed to mean?"
Also, I'm not sure if he was conscious of it, but he seemed to start every other sentence with my name. I sort of understood the position he was in, the pressure, but I was going to hold firm this time.
"I'm sorry," I told him. "The answer is no." "Alex, I'd prefer to keep this between you and me. There's no reason to go up to Ron Burns, is there?"
"No, there isn't," I told Van Allsburg.
"Good,"
he started in, but I cut him off. "Because I'm turning off my pager right now." Chapter 22. I'll admit, when I hung up the phone, my pulse was racing a little, but I felt relieved as well. I thought that Ron Burns would probably back me up on this, but you know what? I didn't even care. An hour later, I was dressed and ready to go be a tourist. "Who wants to have breakfast with Goofy?" I called out. The hotel offered character breakfasts, and it seemed like a good way to channel our energies right back into vacation mode. A little corny, for sure, but sometimes corny is good, real good. Keeps everything in perspective. Janny and Damon came into the suite's living room, both of them looking a little wary. I held out two fists, fingers up. "Each of you pick a hand," I said.
"Daddy, we're not babies anymore," Janny said. "I'm 11. Have you noticed?"
I put on a shocked expression.
"You're not."
It brought out the kind of laughter I was looking for.
"This is serious business," I told them. "I'm not kidding. Now pick a hand, please."
"What is it?"
Damon asked. But I kept mute. Janny finally tapped my left hand, and then Damon shrugged and pointed to the right.
Good choice.
I turned it over and unclenched my fingers. Both kids leaned in for a closer look.
Your pager? Damon asked.
I just turned it off. Now Nana and I are going to wait out in the hall, and I want you two to hide it somewhere.
Hide it good. I don't want to see that thing again. Not until we're back in D.C.
Both Janny and Damon began to whistle and cheer. Even Nana let out a whoop. We were finally on vacation.
Chapter 23.
Maybe there was a silver lining in all this misery and desolation. Not likely, but maybe. Arnold Greiner knew he had exclusive rights to his own story when this terrible mess was all over. And you know what else? He wouldn't settle for just a TV movie. He was going to try to serialize the whole thing in his column and then sell it as a prestige project at one of the studios. Hollywood Under Siege? The War Against the Stars? Bad titles. That was the concept, anyway. He shook his head and refocused on the San Diego freeway. The Xanax he'd taken was making him a little loopy. He'd kept the caffeine going, too, just to maintain some kind of balance through the day. Actually, the morning commute was the hardest time of his day. It was a daily transition from not worrying as much to worrying a lot and feeling sick to his stomach. The closer he got to his office, his desk, his computer, the more anxious he felt. If he knew for certain that another creepy email was coming, it would almost be easier. It was the not knowing part that made it hell. Would Mary be back? Would it happen today? But most important, why was she writing to him? All too soon, he arrived at Times Mirror Square. Greiner worked in the older part of the complex, a 1930s-era building that he had a certain affection for, under normal circumstances anyway. The main doors were large bronze affairs, flanked with imposing twin eagle sculptures. He walked right by them this morning, around to the back entrance, and took the stairs to the third floor. One couldn't be too careful, could one? A reporter named Jenny Bloom fell into step with him the second he hit the newsroom floor. Among all the staff who had shown a sudden interest in his well-being, she was by far the most obvious about it. Or was that odious?
Hey, Arnold, how's it going? You doing okay, man? What are you covering today?
Greiner didn't miss a beat.
Jen, if that's your idea of a pickup line, you must be the most unlaid woman in L.A.
Jenny Bloom merely grinned and kept on coming on.
Spoken like someone with experience in matters of the heart. All right, then, let's skip the foreplay. You get any more emails? You need help on this, right? I'm here for you. You need a woman's point of view. Seriously, I just need some space, okay? I'll let you know if I get anything else.
He turned abruptly and walked away from her.
No, you won't, she called after him. No, I won't, he said, and kept walking.
In some ways, even the annoying distractions were a relief. As soon as he turned away from Bloom, his mind went back into the disturbing loop it had been on before.
Why me? Why did Crazy Mary pick me out? Why not Jenny Bloom? Would it happen again today? Another high-profile murder?
And then it did.
Chapter 24.
A calm, measured female voice said,
911, what is your emergency?
This is Arnold Greiner at the Los Angeles Times. I'm supposed to call a Detective Jean Galetta, but I can't find her number on my desk. I'm sorry, I'm a little rattled right now. I can't even find my Rolodex.
Sir, is this an emergency call? Do you need assistance?
Yes, it's definitely an emergency. Someone may have been murdered. I don't know how long ago this happened, or even if it did for sure. Has anyone called about someone named Marty Lowenstein Bell?
Sir, I can't give out that kind of information.
It doesn't matter. Just send someone to the Lowenstein Bell residence. I think she's been killed. I'm almost sure of it.
How can you be sure?
I just am, okay? I'm almost positive there's been a murder.
What is the address?
The address? Oh, Jesus, I don't know the address. The body is supposed to be in the swimming pool.
Are you at the residence now?
No, listen. This is a... I don't know how to make this clear to you. It's the Mary Smith murder case. The Hollywood celebrity killings. Do you know what I'm talking about?
All right, sir. I think I understand. What was the name again?
Lowenstein Bell. Marty. I know her husband's name is Michael Bell. You might find it under that. I don't know for certain if she's dead. I just got this awful message. I'm a reporter at the L.A. Times. My name is Arnold Greiner. Detective Galletta knows who I am.
Sir, I have the information now. I'm going to put you on hold for just a minute.
No, don't!
Chapter 25 LAPD Dispatch put out a call at 8:42 a.m., sending officers, backup, and emergency medical personnel to the Lowenstein Bell address in Bel Air. Two separate 911 calls on the same incident had come within a few minutes of each other. The first one was from the Los Angeles Times. The second came from the Lowenstein Bell residence itself. Officers Jeff Campbell and Patrick Beneke were first at the scene. Campbell suspected before they arrived that this was another celebrity murder. The address alone was unusual for this kind of call, but dispatch had mentioned a single adult female victim and possible knife wounds. The couple who owned the house were both Hollywood types. It added up to trouble, no matter what. A short, dark-haired woman in a gray and white maid's uniform was waiting in the driveway. She was wringing some kind of towel. As the patrolman got closer, they could see that the woman was sobbing and walking in circles.
"Great," Beneke said. "Just what we need, some Carmelita who doesn't even speak English, bawling her eyes out and acting muy loco."
Campbell responded the way he always did to the younger officer's tiresome, racist cynicism.
"Shut the hell up, Beneke. I don't want to hear it. She's terrified."
As soon as they were out of the car, the maid went hysterical.
"Aki! Aki! Aki!"
she screeched, motioning them toward the front door.
"Aki! Aki!"
The residence was an ultra-modern stone and glass structure high in the Santa Monica Mountains. As he approached, Officer Campbell could see straight through the green glass entryway to the back patio and the sweeping coastal view beyond. What was that on the front door glass? It looked totally out of place. A label or a sticker of some kind. A kitty decal? With a large A on it. He had to practically pry the maid's grip from his forearm.
"Ma'am, just please be calm. Uno momento, por favor. ¿Cómo te llamas?"
The woman may or may not have heard him. Her Spanish came much too quickly for him to understand. She pointed toward the house several more times.
"Let's just get in there," Beneke insisted. "We're wasting time with her. She's living the vida loca."
Two more cruisers and an ambulance pulled up. One of the paramedics spoke quickly and more efficiently with the maid. "In the pool in the back," he reported. "No one else is here, as far as she knows."
"She don't know shit," said Beneke.
"We'll go around," Campbell said. He and Beneke took the north side of the house, their weapons drawn. The other teams went to the south, straight through a set of hedges. Campbell felt the old rush of adrenaline as they worked their way through a dense cluster of hydrangea. Homicide calls used to be almost exhilarating. Now they just made him feel lightheaded and weak in the legs. He squinted through the thick brush as best he could. From what he knew of the Hollywood murders, there was no way the killer would still be around.
"You see anything?"
he whispered to his partner, who was 29, a California cowboy, and a total asshole most of the time.
"Yeah, a bunch of flowers," Beneke answered. "We were the first ones here. Why'd you let them go ahead of us like that?"
Campbell stifled his first response.
"Just keep your eyes open," he said.
The killer could still be here.
That's my hope, Pojo.
They emerged onto a sweeping black slate patio in the back. It was dominated by an enormous dark-bottomed infinity pool. The water seemed to flow right up to and over the edge of the terrace.
There she is, Campbell groaned.
A woman's stark white body floated face down, arms perpendicular to the torso. She wore a lime-green one-piece. Her long blonde hair was splayed gently over the surface of the water. One of the paramedics jumped into the pool and with some difficulty turned her over. He put a finger to her throat, but it was already obvious to Campbell there would be no pulse.
Holy shit!
Campbell grimaced and looked away, then back again. He held his breath to keep everything down.
Who the hell could do something like this?
The poor woman was practically erased from the neck up. Her face was a tangle of cut flesh. The pool's water was tinted bright pink all around the body.
Beneke walked over to get a closer look.
Same killer. I'll bet you anything, same crazy killer did this.
He leaned over to help pull the woman out.
Wait! Campbell barked.
He pointed to the paramedic who was still in the water.
You! Get out of the pool! Get out of the pool right now!
Stone-faced, they all looked at Campbell, but they knew he was right. Even Beneke didn't say a word. There was no sense putting any more of their stamp on the murder scene until an investigative team got there. They would have to leave the victim where she was.
Hey! Hey, guys!
Campbell looked up to see another officer, Jerry Toonley, calling down from a window upstairs.
Office is completely trashed up here. There's broken pictures, stuff everywhere, glass. And get this, the computer's still on and open to a mail program. Looks like someone was sending an email before they left.
Chapter 26.
2 A. Greiner at LATimes.com. From Mary Smith to Marty Lowenstein Bell. I watched you having dinner last night. You and your fine family of five. Very cozy and nice. Mother knows best. With those immaculately clean glass walls of yours, it couldn't have been easier to watch. I enjoyed seeing you with your kids at your last supper. I could actually see the delicious-looking food on your plates, prepared by your cook and nanny, of course. You were having a swell time, and that's fine with me. I wanted you to enjoy yourself on your last night. I especially wanted your kids to have a lasting memory. Now I have a memory of them, too. I'll never forget their sweet faces. Never, ever forget your kids, Marty. Trust me on it. What a beautiful, beautiful house you have, Marty. As befits such an important writer and film director. Is that the right order, by the way? I think so. I didn't come inside until later when you were putting the girls to bed. You left the patio doors open, again, and this time, I used them. I couldn't resist. I wanted to see things just the way you see them, from the inside. Looking out. But I still don't understand why all you rich people feel so safe in your houses. Those big castles can't protect you if you aren't paying close attention. And you weren't. You weren't paying attention at all. Too busy being a mom or too busy being a star. I listened to you upstairs, doing bedtime with the girls. It was kind of touching, and I mean that. You probably thought you would be the last one to tuck them in, but you weren't. Later, when everyone was asleep, I watched each of those girls in her bed, breathing so peacefully. They were like little angels with no cares in the world. I didn't have to tell them they had nothing to worry about, because they already knew. It was just the opposite for you. I decided to wait until the morning, so that I could be with you alone, Madam Director. I'm really glad I waited, too. Your husband, Michael, took the girls to school today. His turn, I guess. That was lucky for everyone, but especially for him. He got to live, and you didn't have to watch him die. And I got you the way I wanted, just the way I had imagined for such a long time. Here's what happened next, Marty. Your last morning started like any other. You did your precious Pilates and then went for laps in the pool. 50 laps, just like always. It must be nice to have such a big swimming pool. Heated, too. I stood and watched you gliding back and forth in the sparkling blue water. Even there, so close. It took you forever to see me. When you finally looked up, you must have been good and tired. Too tired to scream, I suppose. All you did was turn away. But it didn't stop me from shooting you, or then cutting your pretty face to ribbons and shreds. Tell you what, Marty, that was the best part of all. I'm starting to really like defacement. Now, let me ask you one final question. Do you know why you had to die? Do you know what you did to deserve this? Do you know, Marty? Do you know? Somehow, I doubt it.
Chapter 27.
But that wasn't exactly the way it happened, the storyteller knew. Of course he wasn't going to tell the LA Times and the police everything. Only what he needed them to know. Only what was in the story he wanted them to help authenticate. It was such a good story. A hell of a story, if he didn't say so himself. Mary Smith. Jesus. A classic horror tale, if ever there was one. Speaking of stories, he'd heard a good one the other day. The Psychopath's Test. It was supposed to tell you if you had the mind of a psycho. If you got it right, you did. The story went like this. At her mother's funeral, a woman met this guy and fell instantly in love. But she never got his name, number, or anything about him. A few days later, the woman killed her sister. Now, the test. Why did she kill the sister? If you answer correctly, then you think like a psychopath. The storyteller did, of course. He figured it out immediately. This woman killed her sister because she was hoping the guy she liked would appear at the funeral. Anyway, after we killed Marty Lowenstein Bell, he was high as a kite. But he knew he had to stay in control. More or less, anyway. He had to keep up appearances. So he hustled on back to work. He roamed the halls of the office building in Pasadena and talked to half a dozen co-workers about things that bored the living shit out of him, especially today. He wanted to tell every one of them what had just happened, about his secret life, about how none of them got him at all, about how smart and clever he was, and about what an incredible planner, schemer, and killer he was. Jesus, how they love to toss that word around. So-and-so was a killer. This one had a killer smile, a killer act, but it was all such incredible bullshit. All of these people were wimps. They didn't know what real killing was all about. But he sure did. And he knew something else. He liked it a lot. Even more than he thought he would, and he was good at it. He had the sudden urge to pull his gun at the office and start shooting everything that moved, squeaked, or squealed. But hell, that was just a fantasy, a little harmless daydreaming. It would never measure up to the real story, his story, Mary's story, which was so much better.
Chapter 28.
Alex, your office at the FBI called so many times I had to stop answering the phone. Good Lord, what is wrong with those people?
My great-aunt Tia was holding forth at the kitchen table at home, admiring the colorful scarf we had brought her as thanks for house-sitting while we were in California. Nana sat next to Tia, sorting through a thick stack of mail. Our cat Rosie was in the kitchen and looked a bit heavier, if I wasn't mistaken. She rubbed hard up against my legs as if to say, "I'm mad you left,
but I'm glad you're back. Tia sure is a fine cook.
I was glad to be back, too. I think we all were. Christine's taking Alex away to Seattle had more or less ended our vacation, at least the joy in it. My one conversation with her had been tense and also sad. She and I were both so controlled, so intent on not losing our temper, that we ended up with almost nothing to say. But Christine worried me. The ups and downs, the inconsistencies I saw all the time these days. I wondered what she was like with little Alex when I wasn't around the two of them. Alex never complained, but kids usually won't. Now I was back in my kitchen in D.C., feeling almost as if I hadn't had any time off at all. Today was Thursday. I had until Monday morning to not think about work. A resolution that lasted a whole 5 minutes. Almost by habit, I wandered up to my office in the attic. I threw my fat pile of mail on the desk and, without thinking about it, pressed play on the answering machine. Big mistake. Nearly fatal. 9 new messages were waiting for me. The first was from Tony Woods at the Bureau. "Hello, Alex. I've tried paging you a few more times, but haven't had any luck. Please call me at Director Burns's office as soon as you can, and please apologize to your house sitter for me. I suspect she thinks I'm stalking you. Possibly because I am. Call me." I smiled thinly at Tony's dry humor and delivery as a second message from him began. "Alex, Tony Woods again. Please call in as soon as you can. There's been another incident with a murder case in California. Things are most definitely running out of control there. There's a lot of hysteria in L.A. The L.A. Times has finally broken the story about Mary Smith's emails. Call me. It's important, Alex." Tony knew enough not to leave too many specific details on my home phone. He may also have been hoping to hook my curiosity with his vagueness. He did.
Chapter 29. I was fairly certain the latest victim would have to be another Hollywood mother, but I couldn't help wondering if Mary Smith's methods had continued to evolve. And how about the emails to the Times? The TV news and the web would only give me half the story at best. If I wanted to know more, I would have to call in. No, I reminded myself, no work until Monday. No murder cases. No Mary Smith. The machine beeped again, and Ron Burns came on. He was brief and to the point, as he almost always is.
"Alex, I've been in touch with Fred Van Allsburg in L.A. Don't worry about him, but I do need to ask you a few questions. It's important. And welcome back to Washington. Welcome home."
And then another call from Ron Burns, his voice still carefully modulated.
"Alex, we've got a phone conference next week, and I don't want you coming in cold. Call me at home over the weekend if you have to. I'd also like you to speak with Detective Galletta in L.A. She knows something you need to hear. If you don't have her phone numbers, Tony can get them for you."
The implication was clear already. Ron Burns wasn't asking me to stay on this case. He was telling me.
God, I was tired of this. The murders, the horrific cases, one after another. According to estimates at the Bureau, there were more than 300 pattern killers currently operating in the United States. Hell, was I supposed to catch all of them?
I clicked pause on the machine to take a second and decide how I felt about what was going on here. My thoughts went straight back to Mary Smith. I had let her into my head again. She'd caught my interest, my curiosity, probably my ego. A female serial killer. Could it be? Killing other women? Mothers? But why? Why would a woman do that? I didn't think so. I just couldn't imagine it happening, which didn't mean that it hadn't. I also wondered if there had been another email to Arnold Griner. What part did Griner or the L.A. Times play in all this?
Did Mary Smith already have the next victim in her sights? What was her motivation? That was the line of thought that finally got to me. Some unsuspecting woman, a mother, was going to lose her life in L.A. soon. A husband and probably children would be left behind. It hit too close to home for me, and I think Burns knew that when he called. Of course he did. Nearly 10 years before, my own wife, Maria, had been gunned down in a drive-by shooting. Maria had died in my arms. No one was ever convicted or even arrested. My biggest case, and I'd failed on it. It was all so unspeakably senseless. And now, this terrible case in L.A., I didn't need my Ph.D. in psych to know that Mary Smith was pushing all my buttons, both personally and professionally. Maybe I would just check in, I thought. Besides, Burns was right. I didn't want to show up behind the ball on Monday morning. Damn it, Alex, you're weakening. When I picked up the phone, though, I was surprised to hear Damon's voice already on the line.
Yeah, I missed you too. I was thinking about you. I swear I was, all the time.
Then an adolescent girl's laughter.
Did you bring me anything from California Day? Mouse ears? Something? Something?
I forced myself to hang up, quietly. Yeah, I missed you too? Who was this girl? And since when was Day keeping secrets? I had fooled myself into thinking that if a girlfriend came along, he'd want to tell me about it. That suddenly seemed like a silly delusion on my part. I'd been 13 before, too. What was I thinking? One teenage moment down, about 2 million to go. I'd give him 5 minutes and then tell him it was time to hang up. Meanwhile, I went back to the answering machine, where another message was waiting. A real mind blower.
Chapter 30.
Alex, it's Ben Abasian calling on Thursday, 1:30 my time in Seattle. Listen, I have bad news, I'm afraid. It seems that Christine's attorney has filed a motion to move up the final custody hearing date out here. I'm not sure I'll be able to block it, or even that we should. There's more, but I'd rather not go into it until we speak. Please give me a call as soon as possible. My heart picked up its pace. Ben Abasian was my lawyer.